Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, here on EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story, a conversion story. Tonight, we're joined by Seth Haynes. He's a former evangelical Protestant. Seth, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Share your story. It's good to have you here. And hey, let's go back to the beginning. Where does it all begin for you?
I was raised in Texas, right outside of Dallas, and I was very much raised in a deeply religious, deeply evangelical culture. My earliest memories were in the Baptist church with Baptist choirs and Baptist potlucks and, you know, all the things that go along with that. Interestingly, that was not sort of my parents' background. They had actually come into the Baptist church through the charismatic renewal of the Catholic Church, which spilled over to the Episcopalian Church. Mm. And they were Episcopalian at the time, and gotcha. And that's how they came into the church. When they moved to Dallas, they became Baptists, and that's how I was raised.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, what was the upbringing like in terms of practice, in terms of worship?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, every Sunday driving to the church, VBS, you know, during the summers, Sunday school. My mom was very adamant and taught us the scriptures at home. And my dad worked a lot. He wasn't quite as interested. He had been really his conversion within sort of the Episcopal Church had really spoken to him liturgically. The liturgical nature of that is what really drew him into Christianity, mm-hmm. Practicing Christianity. And so when that was kind of removed, he kind of went away with it for a while. And so he worked a lot, attended church when he was off work, but wasn't much of a spiritual presence in the home as much as my mom was, because he worked nights and then would sort of sleep through the day while we were at school. Gotcha. So it was very, it was rich. It was very, you know, biblically informed. We moved to Arkansas when I was six, and I had really significant asthma. And when we moved to Arkansas, we moved right into the sort of north of the river valley, right into the Ozarks, which as an asthmatic and a kid with allergies, it's like literally the worst region in the world you could possibly move into. And so my asthma was really terrible. And as a child, my parents were obviously super concerned about that. And I just had, you know, attack after attack. And with their charismatic background, kind of at the place where they didn't know what else to do, my mom loads me up into a car and takes me to a local Pentecostal faith healing service. And we go through the whole service. And at the end, I sort of go to the front and there's a man in a black suit and gets the Piggly Wiggly olive oil or whatever and anoints me and prays over me and, you know, claims healing for me. And that was a deeply formative moment of my spiritual life because he asked me at the end whether I felt anything. And I was, you know, 6 years old. And so you say what you're supposed to say, which is, yeah, sure. Like Jesus healed me. And I'm sure within a week I had another asthma attack. Mm-hmm. And that moment more than any other in my faith journey was sort of the beginning of my formation of doubt. And so even though I wanted to be a good kid, even though I did all the right things, listened to the right music, read the right books, growing up, there was always that piece in the back of my mind that was like, yeah, this is kind of great. It's what you do, but it didn't really work when I needed it to work.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So you guys are living there in Arkansas. What happened next?
So, you know, I was the prototypical church kid through the 90s. Okay. You know, in evangelical culture in the 90s, there was a lot of, you know, do the right thing, say the right thing. There were a lot of, I don't know if you've encountered this, but there were a lot of CD burnings where you would gather all your secular music and, you know, you'd throw those things into the fire and claim that you wouldn't listen to it anymore. And then you'd just turn around on Monday and go buy, you know, U2's Octoon Baby album again. So, you know, I did all of those things, went on the trips, the mission trips, and in that span of time, I began to wonder, you know, like, am I called to the ministry? Should I go do ministry somewhere? And so I actually went to a Church of Christ school, Harding University, which was in the eastern part of the state, the northeastern part of the state. And as a Baptist there, I was a little bit of an outlier in a Church of Christ school.
How so? Like, what were the differences?
So at the Church of Christ school, first of all, I was a musician, and there were no instruments allowed in worship, right? So it was all a cappella. As a Baptist, we believed, you know, that baptism was a symbol. And of course, they believed it was more sacramental in nature, meaning it was the thing that led you into the church, into salvation. Of course, I was raised on the rapture theology, and they obviously believed that that was not true. They didn't believe that at some point, you know, all the Christians were going to disappear into the air and Jesus was going to, start the tribulation, you know, so there were differences there.
Yeah.
But I was deeply committed to my faith. And so as a result of that, it was a real struggle. You know, when you talk about just like constant debates, constant arguments, and frankly, I didn't really want to do any of that,
yeah.
But because I was outspoken about my faith, had a lot of that. But while I was there, I pursued a secular degree, not a Bible degree, for obvious reasons. But during the summers, I would go back home, or one year I went to Atlanta and I was a Baptist youth intern. So I was continuing to sort of make my way into ministry, or at least explore ministry and what that might look like. And so while I was there my last year, I met my wife, Amber, who is definitely the better half. And she had come from a much different background.
Okay.
She was Church of Christ, but she had decided very early on that she couldn't measure up to the standard of Christianity. And so she had spent years running. She said, I don't want anything to do with the church. I don't want anything to do with Jesus. And she had come to the sort of the end of a rope that the summer before we met, and had decided that things were too out of control. Her life was too wild, and that she wanted to make a change. And so, she didn't know where else to go. So she transferred from the University of North Alabama and moved to Harding University. And in her dorm, within weeks of getting there, she says that she looked in her mirror and she didn't recognize herself, and prayed that Jesus would either save her or take her. And when she didn't die, she got up and started telling everybody that she was a Christian. And so when I met her, she was completely on fire, had a deep Southern accent. She's very attractive. She was not the typical sort of Church of Christ girl that I had run across at Harding. And so I was taken. She got me. She got me pretty immediately. So we started dating and started really talking about the differences, like in our own faith and background, and where we aligned and where we were different. And she said, "Hey, you know, I know you're going to go on and do Baptist youth ministry for a while. I'll follow you for a while, but I don't know that I agree with all this." But that's, we got married, and that's what we did. We went on to be youth ministers for a year.
Wonderful. So where was that at? Where were you?
When we left Harding, we went to Broken Arrow, Oklahoma,
okay.
And there was a large church there, great people. Again, I mean, it was very much the way I was raised, you know, same type of theological structure. It was, at the time, what would have been considered a mega church, although mega churches now are much, much bigger than it was on the outskirts of Tulsa. Our youth ministry was probably, I mean, we probably had 300 or 400 in the youth group, and the target was to try to double that in a certain amount of time.
Wow.
And, I can't really say that we were very good at formation of the youth, but we did pack them into a gym. And to be fair, that team of youth ministers was actually really very good. They weren't interested in selling a bunch of fun or selling, you know, trips, or it wasn't the typical sort of 90s, early 2000s youth experience in evangelical churches. But still, I mean, there were three of us and there were 300 or 400 kids. Like, it was a church within a church.
Yeah.
And after about a year of that, it was just, I was really burned out. I was working too much. Wasn't seeing my wife. We'd been married a year. And so we just kind of decided, like, if this is the lot of ministry, then I probably ought to get out of it and find something that would, you know, if I'm going to work that much, that would pay the bills. So that's what we did. We left the church there, and we moved to Fayetteville, Arkansas, so that I could pursue law school.
Okay. Yeah, and where did you pursue law school at?
So my grandparents lived in Fayetteville, and they had a little rent house behind their old farmhouse, and they said, if you'll go to the University of Arkansas, then you can live here for really cheaply. And so, you know, when you look at your options when you're young and you're married and you're thinking, like, how am I ever going to, you know, support a family? We decided that that was the best option for, you know, money and a place to live. And we were close to my grandparents. And so so that's what we did. And we, you know, I started law school, I guess it was 2001 was my first year. And we just sort of worked through law school. And while we were there, you know, we tried to go back. We did go back for a season back to the Baptist church. And, I led worship for the college ministry there in our town. And it was good. But I was so embittered by my previous experience where I had just been overworked and I felt underpaid. And, you know, in that big mega church, you know, sort of structure, the ministers at the bottom are sort of the first forgotten. And so there just came a point where it felt like every time I walked into church, it wasn't what it was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And to go back in the story a little bit, when I was in fourth grade, my parents enrolled us in Catholic school. So my sister was needing some kind of smaller class sizes, wanting a sort of academic change for both of us. And so my parents put us in Catholic school. And I remember very, very early on in Catholic school thinking, even with all my biblical formation, I remember very, very early on thinking there's something qualitatively different about this space. Like when I walk into this space, I feel something. Now, I was in fourth, fifth, sixth grade, so I couldn't have told you exactly what I felt, but it just felt very different. And the very first school mass that I went to, I remember walking in. There was a nun named Sister Sarto, a sister named Sister Sarto, and she continually told me on our walk from the school to the church building, "Hey, don't take the Eucharist." And she must have told me four times, like continue to tell me as if I had forgotten what she had said 30 seconds previous. And I get it. I'm not going to take the Eucharist. So
she worked with a lot of kids.
Yeah, clearly. So we go through the whole, we're going through the mass and I have no idea what's happening. Mm-hmm. The closest frame of reference I have is the Episcopalian church that my grandparents went to, but I only went to church with them once or twice a year. So I had no idea what was happening. And I remember when we got to the passing of the peace, she looked at me and she extended her hand and the invitation was like, "Hey, this is for you. Like you get to participate in this part of the mass." And I remember thinking how beautiful it was that there was a part for me in the mass. Yeah. And when I was, you know, much later in my life, and I was sitting here like with no peace in church, no peace from where I had come, and I was, you know, standing here frustrated with sort of the Baptist reality that I was living, I remember thinking, like, I don't sense or feel that qualitative difference. I don't sense or feel that peace here. And so we left and we started going to a local non-denominational mega church. And I tried my best to pull out of ministry, although I could never really shake it.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. And so at this point, you're still continuing to study law school?
Yeah. So I graduated from law school in 2004. Okay. I accepted a job with a firm that was based out of Little Rock, which is our capital, but they had a branch up in Northwest Arkansas where I live. So I started working there, still, you know, continued to lead worship, play music at church, and was very active in church. We had joined a very small church that quickly grew to a very large church. And then, you know, for years there, man, it was just like, it was life, you know. You get up, you go to work, you come home, you do that on repeat. We started having kids, and really just started the process of like living life as a family. And we, you know, about three kids deep, it was very normal. Everything was very normal. Mm-hmm. And then my fourth child, Titus, came along, and that's when things really got real and really changed. And very early on, he was smaller, and that was okay. About 10 months in, 9 or 10 months in, he started stagnating in his weight gain. So he wasn't growing anymore. He wasn't gaining any weight. And if there's anything that, like, babies are supposed to do, right, it's like sleep, eat, and gain weight. Like, right. That's really their only job at that point. And he was doing only two of the three things, you know. So he wasn't gaining weight. And about about 10 months in, he started actually losing weight. Mm. And so the doctors got very concerned and did a stent in our local hospital. And then the local hospital was kind of a little bit, didn't know what to do with him. And so sent us to Children's Hospital in Little Rock. And I think that was the beginning of my Catholic journey. Okay. So we went to Little Rock, and I remember it's a song that still gets me. There's this old tune by this Christian artist named Rich Mullins called "The Love of God," and he talks about the reckless raging fury that they call the love of God.
Mm, yeah,
and I remember driving into Little Rock with my, you know, starving kid in the back and listening to this song on repeat and just thinking like, here we go. Like, this is going to be a really tough season. We checked in the hospital. You do all the things that you're supposed to do. After about a week, the doctors came in and they said, the primary doctor on his case said, I don't really know what to do. We've done everything that we can do. I think all that we know now is to like make him comfortable, because at this point he was like actually losing his food. He couldn't take anything in without losing it.
Right.
And so when he said, you know, all we know left to do is to make him comfortable, my first thought was like, no, that's impossible. Like, we're not having this conversation. And so he walks out of the room, and I did take a minute, and then I tracked him down, and I was like, that is not acceptable. Like, we have to figure this out. So that's the first thing I did, was just say, I don't care what you have to do, you have to figure this out. The second thing I did was call my sister who lives in Little Rock. And this is going to sound terrible, but she's a saint for this. I said, I need you to bring me a Nalgene bottle of gin. And I need it like now. And you know, it was a very dark season. She knew exactly what was happening. And so she did. She brought me an Nalgene bottle of gin, and I went up to the break room, and they had this like crushed ice, you know, like the ice that you get at like Sonic or something.
Yeah.
The perfect ice.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. My wife loves that ice.
Yeah. It's the best ice. So I took this big cup and I filled it with ice, and I put a couple lemons in it because they had some cut lemons there. And then I just filled it with gin and I just started going to town. Like, I did not want to feel anymore. And so that's what I did. I started drinking really, really hard that night. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens next? Did they find anything out? Were they able to figure out?
Yeah. So interestingly, I think there was a little bit of competition between the two GI doctors who were there at Children's at the time. And, one was rotating off the floor and another was coming on. And so the next day, the new doctor sort of came onto the floor and took over the case. And he came in and he said, you know, I've reviewed the file. The doctor's right. We've done everything we can think to do. Okay. There's one thing left we can do. And the one thing left was to feed him through a tube, less calories than he needed to survive, but to slowly try to increase it so that his stomach would stretch, so that potentially he could hold more food. And the doctor was really clear, like, we're really on the tail end of this timeline. And so right. if we can't get him to hold the food before the clock runs out, then like the doctor was right. But lo and behold, like it started to work. And so every day they would increase just a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And right before his first birthday, so, and I think it was maybe three or four weeks. I can't remember anymore. Yeah. But after we had checked into the hospital, they released us. And they released us at home. They sent us home with a feeding tube and all the medicine that we needed and all these things. And so we went home and we started the regimen of, you know, learning how to insert feeding tubes and learning how to feed him through a tube and all of these things. And that was a really dark season, too, because at the time, you know, we didn't know what the outcome was going to be. We still didn't know if he'd make it. We didn't know. It was kind of still touch and go. And so during that time period, two things happened. One, I was in like this little men's prayer group. It was four very, very close friends. And I was really, really tired of being prayed for. And the reason I was tired of being prayed for is because like it didn't seem to be working. And I kept thinking back to like the one time I needed prayer to like really work for me and my asthma, it didn't work.
Right.
And now here I am with my son and it's not working. And everybody's telling me they're praying for me and that's super great, but like it doesn't seem to be doing anything. So I went to this prayer meeting and you know, fall in the Ozarks is like magic. It's the only way I know how to say it. And if you can live in the Ozarks through a full fall as an atheist and come out on the backside as an atheist, like something's wrong with you because it's that beautiful. Like it will convert you. Just the beauty of it will convert you. And I remember getting out in the peak of fall colors, getting out of a car to go to this men's prayer breakfast. And this guy, my friend Travis, had set up a table and we were going to pray outside. And I walk over and I slam my hands down on the table and I say, I'm done. I will pray no more. Mm. And you guys pray for Titus if you want, but don't tell me about it. And I got up and I walked to my car and I got in it. I drove to my office. And I decided I was going to work and drink. And for the next year, that's exactly what I did.
Okay. Well, maybe that's a good place to take a break. You know, we'll pick it up here again in a few minutes and hear what happened in that dark place.
Yeah. But,
all right. Well, we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Seth's story. I want to remind you that if you yourself are on a journey, and perhaps if you're in a dark place on that journey, there are people that want to pray for you and help you encounter the love of Jesus. They do want to pray for you. And answer your questions about prayer and about our Lord. Check out chnetwork.org and send us a message. Again, we'd love to hear about your journey. We'd love to assist you. We have many stories there like Seth's that may be an inspiration and encouragement to you on your journey. Once again, we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Seth's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our program tonight, speaking with Seth Haynes. He's a former evangelical Protestant. And when we left off in your story, Seth, we left off in a very dark place, you know, with your son's condition that you didn't seem to have any answers about, and you'd begun to drink, and you just sort of dropped the bomb on your prayer group that you were stepping away. Pick us up there. What happened next?
Yeah. So later that year, it was actually September of that year, so it had been a full year, I went to a conference that was kind of an evangelical conference, but it was about human care, sort of social justice issues, and I was actually there to talk about some very particular orphan care issues, both as an attorney, but also I had been writing in that space, and we had done some work in adoption spaces. So I was kind of there to to speak about that.
You gotten into writing too?
I had. At that point, I had already started to write a little bit. And part of that was because my wife was writing. She was an author. She was in the poetry program there at the university. And so we were sort of starting to write together. And so I end up at this conference. It was at a Methodist church in downtown Austin was where it was hosted. And the night before I was supposed to speak, maybe it was the night after I actually spoke, I just got absolutely ripped. I mean, just thought, okay, no more obligations. Like, it was kind of a good party. There were great people there that were drinking a little bit. They didn't realize how much I was drinking at the time. And I just stayed up way too late, drinking way too much. And the next morning I woke up and I was in the foyer of this church. And the doors opened and I looked at the doors, and through the doors walked this woman. And it was the most... It was really a surreal experience because I was super hungover, right? And so, like, the light coming through, like, hurt my eyes, and I just wanted to hide under a table or something, like I was, you know, a vampire or something. But when the doors closed and I kind of could focus on her, it was a woman that I had known. Her name was Heather. She was from Minnesota, and she had shown up at this conference. I had no idea, like, how could she possibly be here? Well, Heather was a recovering alcoholic. She was in recovery at the time. And I happened to know that about her because we were riding in some of the same circles. What I did not know is that she had just moved to Austin. And what I also did not know was that she had somehow found out about this conference and said, well, I'm going to go see Seth. You know, we've been riding in the same circle for a while. So I make my way across the lobby. And what I should have said was, you know, good morning, or how are you, or hey, it's good to see you. But what I said was, how did you know you had a drinking problem? And it was kind of like the minute that the words came out, I was like, come back words. Like, I wish I hadn't said that out loud to you as the greeting for the morning. But as I was walking over to her, I really did feel about the closest thing I could to like an audible voice saying, like, you can either take care of this now or it's going to get really bad. And here's Heather, right? And so the minute I said, you know, how did you know you had a drinking problem? She looked at me and she just nodded and she said, you know, don't you? And I did. So she did not push me one way or another with respect to recovery, which most people who are in recovery spaces that know that, they're pretty good about holding stories, you know. And she said, if you know a therapist, maybe, you know, give them a holler, see what they recommend, see if they recommend AA or something else, some other form. So I got back to Fayetteville and I called a therapist friend I knew and I told him what was going on. And he said, you know, the good news is, or the bad news is that you're bad enough to come see me. But the good news is that I have an availability on Monday. So I'll see you Monday at 11. So I show up Monday at 11, and some very important things happened there. One, he told me, let's not go to AA yet. And some of that was because he was aware of the story with my son. He was aware of my, like, utter pushback against God and prayer. And his rationale was, I'm afraid that if you go to AA, you're not going to find your higher power, and that's going to be a real problem. And so instead, let's pursue something else, which is kind of like an inner healing work, and let's do the work of like actually addressing your underlying issues and the pain that you have with God from your past, from being a child not being healed, and the pain that you're carrying now with your son. Let's deal with that, and then let's move forward into healing. And if you're able to moderately drink one day, great. And if you're not, great. But we're not here to address the drinking. Stop drinking, but we're here to address this other part. And if you get healed, then you won't need the medication, the alcohol. And turns out he's very right, which was, ends up being a beautiful thing. But one of the things that happened in those therapy sessions, so I met with him every week, once a week for an hour, for 90 days. And somewhere along the way, he said, hey, I want you to listen to this woman. Her name was Sue Johnson. She was a she does emotionally focused therapy. It was couples therapy. But he said, there's this one particular thing I want you to listen to. I think there's something in there for you. So I listened to this YouTube video. You know, I'm sitting at my desk after a therapy session with, you know, my deli sandwich and Sue Johnson's, you know, video. And she starts talking about attachment. And she starts talking about how in strongly attached marriages, how you're able to endure harder things, like cancer recovery rates are higher, being able to beat addiction is higher. Like if you have a strong bonded attachment, you're actually able to overcome these things. My wife and I have always had a really good relationship, and so I felt really good there. But as I listened to her, she kept saying attachment over and over and over again. And so I thought, surely someone in all of Christianity has written about attachment. Mm-hmm. So I type in the words in Google, attachment, Christian, addiction, and all of a sudden I'm introduced to St. Ignatius of Loyola. And that was really, really the beginning of my journey, because I realized all of a sudden, here's a person who wrote about all of the things that I'm struggling with for, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Right.
Those things still exist. They're still being used. And I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
Because in my Protestant context, there would be no reason to hear of them. Mm-hmm. Right. We only are really encouraged to read, you know, the scriptures, and the scriptures should be sufficient. And so why do we need people like St. Ignatius?
And for those who aren't familiar with him, you know, his work focuses on the discernment of spirits, sort of the movements of the heart, the emotions, sort of bringing that together and understanding that in the context of our faith.
Yeah.
Is that what you found in him?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. And I did the thing that you're not supposed to do, which is I read the spiritual exercises with no leader, no guide, no, you know, no spiritual director. But as I read through the exercises, it was just, I mean, beautiful. All of a sudden it was like, oh, there are ways to approach this spiritually and imaginatively that can like really help me overcome this particular struggle. And one of the things that I read, there's a in the back of the exercises, there's this one particular exercise on eating and drinking food. And Ignatius says, like, when you go to the table, you know, and you're surrounded by all this food, this wine, whatever, that can tempt you to be intemperate or whatever, a glutton, imagine Jesus and the disciples at the table with you, and eat as Jesus and his disciples would eat, and drink as they would drink. That's a very, very loose paraphrase. But the minute I read that, I was like, oh, I get it. Like, this is actually the most helpful thing for my stage and my place. Mm-hmm. And in the kind of pain that I was in, maybe I shouldn't eat and drink, because maybe Jesus wouldn't be drinking in this kind of pain. And so it just gave me this framework for really helping to understand what does temperance and moderation and all those things really look like. And sometimes it looks like seasons of deep, deep, deep abstinence.
Right. Yeah, it's a great thought experiment, exercise to kind of get us thinking along the lines of virtue there. Because we spend much of our lives eating and drinking, or not eating and drinking, or whatever it is, you know, just because of the whims or our emotions, what we're responding to, but to make both of them intentional. Mm-hmm. No, if I'm going to eat and drink, it's for a purpose. It's for nourishment, or it's a celebration. Or I'm going to not as a fast, as a way of offering it up, as a way of drawing closer to the Lord, making both those intentional. Yeah. So at this point, what was going on with your son?
So he was actually doing a lot better looking back. I mean, we still felt like it was touch and go. Looking back, I can say it was an upward trend. I mean, he's still with us today, and he's doing really well, and
he's got
playing basketball and doing all the things 12-year-olds do,
wonderful.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and he's an amazing kid, and he wouldn't change anything, and I wouldn't change anything. So, so I can say that now. At the time, it still felt like in a very emotionally fraught time. But as I kind of started to get my feet underneath me, there was a moment when we went to this little prayer circle. There was a guy from Portland, Oregon, a friend of a group of us. He was kind of a mutual friend, and he was talking about running evangelical pilgrimages, and he wanted to do a pilgrimage to a an agrarian kind of context, and what's more agrarian than Arkansas was kind of his idea. And so we met, a group of us met one night to kind of talk about what it might look like. And at the end of the night, there was some leftover bread and wine. Of course, it'd been 7 or 8 months maybe since I'd stopped drinking. I'd had nothing to drink. And a local pastor there said, well, we have this bread and wine. Let's pass it around the table. And let's do the Lord's Supper. And so they start to pass the bread and wine around this circle. And Amber was to the right, my wife, and she was the one who was passing out the elements. And so she started going this way around the circle. So I was last.
Is this something you guys had done before?
No, it was just a group of friends.
Okay, so this is a new sort of spiritual practice.
Totally. Okay. It was just, you know, we had done communion at church or whatever, but this was just a group of believers who were like, hey, we believe in this, so let's do it. Okay. So, they get about halfway around the circle, and you can kind of see the collective, oh no, wait a second, we haven't thought this through, because here's the wine going around and Seth's going to have to drink it. And so one of my friends brought out some white grape juice for me, which was pretty hilarious. And I was like, it's good, man. And the reason why I said it'll be fine is because my grandma had been in recovery for years and years. And she had made a comment to me, because she was Episcopalian, she always took the communion wine. And she had made the comment to me that if my sobriety is not enough to withstand, you know, the communion cup, then I need to rethink my sobriety. And so her words kind of were ringing in my head. And so when the cup came around to me, I took the bread, I dipped it in the wine, and I ate it. And I had an experience that I can't explain. And it was as if, to me, like, you know, when you were a kid and you like flew off your handlebars and like you scraped your hand and then you like sucked your hand because it was stinging so badly. But it was that kind of like sense, that flavor of like, of actual, you know, the blood that you have on your hand and the flesh that you have on your hand. And don't understand it, can't explain it. Second guess it all the time, ask myself all the time, was that real? Did that really happen? And when we left that night, of course I broke down crying. And when we left that night, Amber was like, what happened? And I told her, and I said, we've got to figure this out. Like, there's something here. I don't know what it is, but we have to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And so the next day I called a friend, and the friend recommended a book on sacramentality to me. And I read the book, and in the first chapter, it was about the Eucharist. And as I read about sort of the historical context of the Eucharist and support for it and why it made sense sort of both intellectually but from an emotional apologetic too, all of a sudden, I was like, yeah, this is the thing. And so that began the process of us trying to figure out how do we participate sacramentally in the Eucharist.
Right. Which is a very, from both your backgrounds, a very different flavor of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
right? Neither of you came really from a sacramental, liturgical, even worship style, right? It was more,
That's right. And now, my dad did, while I was at Catholic school, my dad did convert to Catholicism. He became a Catholic, and so he was kind of always in the background, like sort of, you know, sniping, you know, at us, you know, trying to suggest certain things. But but I don't know that I ever really took him all that seriously. Sure. But from a, yeah, definitely from like the perspective of how we grew up, from a worship perspective, it was very, very, very different.
Gotcha.
So we Googled, like, you know, where do you go? Because, you know, we did not, you know, we knew we couldn't go to the Catholic Church because we can't participate in the Eucharist. Mm. We didn't necessarily want to go to a church that was like overtly political either. And a lot of liturgical churches, for whatever reason, have bent one way or another politically. And we kind of wanted to go not for that, but for Jesus. So we ended up finding a small Anglican church that we went to, and I think, you know, we walked in, the six of us, because there are six in my family, we walked in one Sunday, and we doubled the church size, because they had just started.
Wow.
But But the other six people that were there were, you know, our age, kind of interested in the same things, not looking to make any political statements, just trying to sort of understand what it meant to live the sacramental life. And so we really dug in there and continued to ask questions about sacramentality and attachment and what does it mean to kind of live out an authentic spiritual life in communion.
Right. Okay. Well, what did you discover as you did that?
Well, we discovered a lot of things. one thing that we discovered is I think the impulse is good and right.
Yeah.
The impulse towards, hey, let's plant a church that actually celebrates and believes in this sort of sacramental worldview is right. We discovered that the impulse of starting the story not from like the fall, not from sin, but starting the story at God created and it was good, was very freeing too. Like, yeah, we mess up. Yes, we're going to sin. But if the world is good, everything created is good. If God created me to participate in that goodness, and if there are sacramental elements that allow me to participate in that Eucharist, then that's really beautiful. But what we also found is that it was a church plant, and it was, in some senses, it felt, you know, very bootstrap, very upstart, very much trying to create new ways of being, new modes of being, and it was just a lot of hard work. And so we did that for a long time, and we invited a priest, a new priest. The priest came and took over the church. And to be tactful, he was not healthy. It was a very unhealthy situation. And very early on, I knew it was unhealthy. And very early on, he identified Amber as, you know, sort of an up-and-coming minister. And he made her the curate of the church. She began the ordination process. And it was just really, really clear to me that it was not healthy.
Okay.
So at one point I just told her, like, this doesn't feel right to me. I still like love the sacramentality of it. I love what we're trying to do here. It doesn't feel right. And so I took my oldest son to a basketball practice one night. I dropped him off and I had like an hour and a half to kill and I didn't want to go all the way back home. So I ran to a local bookstore and I was looking at the shelves and I ran across the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which I had never even dreamed of reading.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, this is fascinating and interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I grabbed it and I sat down in a little cafe and I started reading it. And then I bought it. And then I went and picked up my son, took him home, read it some more. And I kept reading and I kept reading and I kept reading. And as I read the pages, I was like, oh, this is like my language. This makes so much sense to me. Everything in here makes so much sense to me. And Amber and I had actually a trip planned the following weekend. And I sit on this plane and I read this passage to her. I'm like, listen to this. So I read this passage to her. And a woman turns around and she says, are you reading the Catechism? And I said, yeah, totally. How did you know that? And she was a traveling evangelist who like goes all around the country speaking to youth groups and college groups. And she said, well, I just left, you know, the university. I was speaking to a group of kids and I know that passage in the Catechism and I talk about it all the time. And isn't it so beautiful? And so we started to have this conversation on the plane about the beauty of the Catechism. And it was just like another little moment of like confirmation of like, hey, you're on the right path. And so began to go through RCIA because I told Amber, listen, I know you're in ordination, but I got to do this. And so I went through RCIA with her blessing, got all the way to the weekend before the Easter Vigil.
Mm-hmm.
And right before the Easter Vigil, I tell the priest more of my situation because I was convinced that I could somehow still balance going to the Anglican church every Sunday while my wife's in ordination and going to, you know, St. Joe's, our local Catholic church. And, but there'd been some tension and some conflict around it.
Right.
And he told me, there are more important things than becoming Catholic tomorrow, which was the Easter Vigil. He said, you made a covenant vow to your wife. That's a sacramental vow. You have to honor that and think through that. And if it's going to if this is going to somehow negatively impact or affect that, I think you need to just pause and wait for your wife. And I thought, there's no way my wife's ever going to become Catholic. Mm-hmm. But okay, it's what the priest says. That's what I'll do. So I was not confirmed. That would have been the Easter Vigil of 2019. Mm-hmm. And so I go home and I tell my wife, and 3 weeks later, she had said, I need to pull out of this process, of my ordination process. I need to think through, you know, because this relationship with the priest is like really unhealthy. I think the church feels unhealthy. And from that moment on, like her entire ministry, for a variety of reasons, just fell apart. And we ended up with no church home, nowhere to go. And she said, hey, I have this idea. I'll go with you to St. Joe's. And this would have been in September. This was September of 2019. She said, I'll go with you to St. Joe's. And she did. And from the minute she stepped in the door, she said, this feels like home. This is where I want to be. And they had started, they were starting RCIA the next week. And she was like, I'll start RCIA. And I was like, are you sure? Like, are you sure about this? Like, this is really fast. And her logic was, well, I can always pull out. Like, I can always just not go through with it. Right. But as she went through the process, she just found like, yeah, like, I don't understand all this. I struggle to believe all of it. Mm-hmm. I don't feel the need to actively teach against any of it. Mm-hmm. And this is where Jesus is. Right. And if this is where Jesus is, shouldn't we be here?
You mentioned also use the phrase sacramental worldview. I think that's an important part of many of these stories, is just that there are the individual doctrines and practices and thing, you know, questions to work through. But a big part of it, I think, is just coming to recognize that my worldview doesn't quite fit my experiences and what I see in the world and what we see in the faith. And I think many people, as you've been reading the catechism, going through RCAA, little dots get dotted and T's get crossed, but the bigger picture is that this sort of fits, worldview, this paradigm fits what I've seen, what I've experienced.
Yes. Yeah. And that's where, again, like when you begin to cultivate that attachment to Christ, you can start to see that fit. I mean, even if you are not a great prayer, like we were talking before about some of my prayer formation was not really great, but as I struggle through, like, what does it look like to be attached to Christ? What is the mind of Christ? What does it mean to like live as Christ? Like, sacramentality is it. It's all of it. And so being in a place where you have all of the sacraments that feed you, nourish you, heal you, it actually helps you feel like, oh yeah, this fits. I fit well now. I don't feel homesick anymore. That's how I would have described, and I did in fact describe myself for years and years and years as homesick. Like, I can't wait to get to heaven because I'm homesick. Yeah. I don't feel that anymore. I feel like a fit. So we went through, you know, Amber finished her RCIA journey. We got all the way to the Easter Vigil in 2020. And of course, the pandemic was raging. So we did not get to come in. We watched the Easter Vigil at home on Zoom with just the priest in the sanctuary all by himself. Very heartbroken. And, you know, it was a while, but in May of that year, we were finally allowed into the church, and because we were allowed into the church building.
Yeah.
So we had a mass. We were the first family that came in for our parish, in 2020. And then, you know, other families began to follow as we, you know, expanded the numbers that could be in the sanctuary at one time. And that's when we came in.
Well, praise God. We have about 5 minutes left, so talk to us a little bit about what happened after, you know, and what impact that's had on your family. And you mentioned prayer a little bit. What's happened since then?
Yeah, it's been really good. It's been really interesting. In some ways, I've never felt more, and maybe this is too much to say in 5 minutes, but in some ways I've never felt more, I don't know if attacked is the right word, or sinful, or aware of my sin. Maybe aware of my sin is probably the best way to put it. I've never felt more aware of my sin. But at the same time, I've never felt more free of it at the same, you know, by the same token, you know, through participation in the sacraments, like I have felt more myself. I have felt more free. I felt less the need to like strive to check all the boxes and do all the things, which has been really beautiful. And I think Amber would say the same thing. The community that fell apart, that Anglican community, some of our dearest friends were in that community, and our relationships with them have been perfectly mended.
Okay.
We're still very, very close. They, you know, they've gone on, they've, you know, the priest has moved on and they've gotten someone new, and it's a much healthier situation, and that healthier situation has brought a lot of healing between both of us. So there's still a good bit of ecumenism there, which has kind of always been where we've landed, right, wrong, or indifferent. It's kind of always been where we've been. So we feel very at home in our relationships, and we do not feel the need to do anything other than what we're doing. And I think it's the first time that we would both say, like, we feel perfectly at home and don't feel the need to look anywhere else.
Yeah. Well, beautifully. Yeah. You've, I don't want to open a big conversation, but you used the term attachment a couple of times. I know that's, it's not a specifically religious term, but in terms of looking at the relationship with God, it sounds, that sounds like healthy attachment in the sense of, you know, finding a way of being Christ, you know, faith, the Catholic Church, the sacramental worldview, the sacramental, the sacraments themselves, to be able to feel more yourself and be aware, again, more aware of your weaknesses and faults, because you're not, there's not a defensiveness, there's not a need to guard those.
Absolutely.
I can be open to those, I can be realistic about those, because I do have a Father that loves me, I do have a Savior that comes down, remains present with me in the sacraments. I mean, that's, it's funny that, it's, again, it's a secular term and framework, but we find in the Church that even on a psychological level, by God's grace, it addresses us in those ways, you know.
In our relationship. John Michael Talbot, who I loved growing up, because he's a guitar player. I'm a guitar player.
Nice.
I heard, I wish I could find it, and I can't, but he had this, he talks about this moment when somebody approached him and said, all what you're saying is all fine and good, but how do you know that's not just psychological mumbo jumbo? And his response, at least on this video, was he looked at the guy and he said, did God not give me psychology? And I thought it was such a brilliant response, because what I found in, particularly through the sacrament of confession, is that just is that just psychological? I don't really know. Maybe it is, but God gave me the grace to have my psychology righted every time I go in and come out of that confession. And I just feel so free in ways that I never did before. And so, God God certainly works through the sacraments for those graces.
Well, I think that's precisely an aspect of the sacramental worldview, I'm going to use that term, is that nothing is ever just, right? That's one of the big differences, I think, is right. Like for the materialist, reductionist, you know, the world is always less than, right? Reason is merely rationalization. Love is merely lust. Confession is merely, no, it's not merely anything. If that's a part of it, our psychology, how God designed us. But it's also, everything is always more. And that's the thing, we sense that in the world. And I think the world, the Catholic worldview puts flesh to that, that that's the world we live in, the universe we live in, that it's always more. It's never merely just. And so as we dig into these things, we've, again, on the psychological level, on the bodily level, on the spiritual level, that they all are woven together.
And it's beautiful.
All right, brother. Well, we have about a minute left. For someone, again, coming from your background, maybe again from a Protestant tradition, who has a yearning maybe for the more sacramental worldview, or a person who's experienced deep loss or deep turmoil, maybe wrestling with God, what is a word of encouragement you might share with them today before we go?
I mean, I go back to what Ignatius said, which is, wherever you are, in whatever moment you exist in, sit down at your table and eat as Christ would drink, eat and drink as Christ would drink, try to pray as Christ would pray, try to move as Christ would move, even if you don't believe it. Try to do those things and just see what happens.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, thanks so much, Seth, for sharing your story.
Thanks.
I'm praying for you and your family on a continued journey.
Thank you.
Right? That's part of the reminder here on this show. Again, that we're all on a journey, and it's great to listen to a story, how the Lord has worked in somebody else's life. But the reality is God's working in your life. He's done great things in your life. You may not have recognized those, but you need to tell your story as well. So pray through that. Find the ways that God's worked in your life and ask Him every day what's next, because He's present to you and He loves you. So thanks again for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Seth's story was an inspiration to you. Continue the journey. Let's be praying for each other. We'll be back again next week with another story. Until then, God bless.